And this week on The Green Desk, I spoke to Dr. David Suzuki. Now, David Suzuki is a Canadian environmentalist. He was here last week to release his latest book, Good News for a Change. He was once a geneticist, but now he opposes genetic modification. He's recently retired as a professor in zoology, and he was also a professor of sustainable development at the University of Vancouver. He was awarded a United Nations Environment Programme Medal. He's published over 300 scientific articles and is a seasoned television and radio broadcaster. He's made numerous nature and environmental documentaries and has published 32 books. 15 of those were for kids. I spoke to David Suzuki while he was here for his book launch in Auckland, and he was also on his way to Wellington for Writers Week. And this is what he had to say. Well, welcome to The Green Desk, Professor Suzuki.
Thank you.
You're the author of more than 30 books, and you're here in New Zealand to release this new one called Good News for a Change. How does this book differ from a lot of the other books presently out there on the market that focus on environmental issues?
Well, a lot of my books have been warning about the dire straits the environment's in. And so the business press loves to portray me as a doctor of doom and gloom, that I come in with an anti-business or a neo-Luddite position. And fortunately, the reception in Australia and New Zealand has been very good to those ideas. But over the years, I've had many people come up and say, you know, I've listened to your story, I agree with what you're saying, but what options are out there? I feel so helpless. And I realized that enough people have heard the message, but they feel disempowered because the problem seems so immense and there are no obvious solutions. So a couple of years ago, with Holly Dressel, I said, let's look to see whether there are any real solutions out there. And I'm talking not about just picking up litter and recycling a few glass bottles. I'm talking about changes that represent a fundamentally different way of looking at the world, that get us off onto what might be sustainable in the future. When we started, I said to Holly, gee, I hope we can find enough examples to fill a book. And by the time we were halfway through, it was obvious that we could fill volumes. In fact, the good news is there's lots of good news out there. Lots of people, lots of organizations, even businesses that are making a profit and doing the right thing by the environment. Governments are doing things that are the right thing. So the challenge now is to spread that news, because the depressing thing is, even though there are lots of solutions out there, they're not being implemented widely.
Even though there's lots of good news out there, as you say, at what rate is environmental change and environmental degradation happening? And how fast are we going to be able to change that sort of capitalist paradigm to meet the rate of extinctions, the rate of human-induced climatic change?
I don't see it as a capitalist thing. I mean, I think the socialists and the communists are caught up in exactly the same sort of thing. But you're absolutely right. We are in a race, and right now the juggernaut that is destroying the Earth is the dominant entity that is accelerating, if anything. So we're in a terrible race. We have now the examples that things can be done a different way. But the question is whether they can become the dominant way of thinking in time to save enough so that the resilience and flexibility of the environment is still out there. We're still going in the wrong direction, without a doubt.
I was interested to read in your book that companies such as Nike and IKEA, out of all of them, are putting in place new technologies and carrying out research to be more environmentally sustainable. Isn't it kind of closing the gate after the horse has bolted, as both these companies have been exposed as being less than socially responsible?
Well, the question is, do we just keep hammering them, or does there come a time when you have to at least try to encourage them when they do the right thing? Quite honestly, it makes me sick in many cases to have to put some of these companies in Good News for a Change, because they've been such bad characters in the past. I think of BP and Shell, which have been, Shell especially, as you know, in the Niger Delta in Nigeria, has really been killing people. They've got an army that goes out there. The Ogoni people are being poisoned by the wells and the flaring there. But when they then commit $200 million to solar energy, do we want to be pure and say, oh, they're still nasty, and not mention them? Or do we say, well, you know, we still don't like what you're doing, but you've done the right thing here, and so we acknowledge you. And our choice was to acknowledge them. Same thing with Nike. Nike is putting a PR spin on the fact that they have an environmental group now, because they took a heavy hit when it was found that their shoes are being made in sweatshops in Asia. But at the same time, if you don't encourage them by acknowledging them and giving them credit when they've done the right thing, then I don't see that they'll ever want to do the right thing. So this is what we do, and it is encouraging that the Nike environmental group is growing. Sarah Severn is a very impressive woman that I think is really committed and wants to do the right thing. They want to have a shoe that you'll be able to tear apart and reuse everything in that shoe, which is the way they've got to go anyway. IKEA, I think, is very well along the line to having completely green lines of furniture. So you have to give them credit.
Anita Roddick's out here at the moment from the Body Shop, and you talk about Anita in your book. How hard is it for companies like the Body Shop, she's sort of, and other companies, to actually be sustainable when they're up against this responsibility to pay out to shareholders first and foremost?
You know, that's the absolutely critical question. And Anita, we quote Anita very extensively on this. As long as the Body Shop was a privately held company, she could continue with her plans to use the great success of the Body Shop to fund the venture she was interested in. You know, she didn't start out to become a wealthy capitalist or businesswoman. She started a business in order to fund the thing she wanted, you know, to fight against violence against women, to protect the environment, to help indigenous people. And she was very successful at doing that. But when she needed the capital to fund her continued expansion, she encountered the reality that investors couldn't give a fig about what she is doing to help the world. And their whole thrust is to maximize profit. And the irony, since we published the book, she's been booted out as the head of that company by the shareholders.
Do you think that it encourages people who want to invest in ethically sound companies to go out and buy shares for companies such as the Body Shop? Or do you just think that people just use share traders, they get shares with whomever, and they just want money? They don't care if it's ethical or not.
The whole thrust of investment has become completely distorted by the demand of the shareholder to maximize their investment in as short a time as possible. My understanding is there was a time when the stock market was an opportunity for the investor to say, I like that company, I like what they're doing, I'm going to put my money and help on them and help them. And if you make the right choice and it's a good company, it's successful, then you benefit by the increase in the share price of that company. Now people invest, they don't give a damn what the company is doing. They just say, oh, you know, IT, information technology, that's where it's at. I better invest in that one. And they want to make their money. They'll pull their money out in a week or so if suddenly the share price goes up. Then they take their profits and run. So it's become a terrible reality that 97%, I think, of investment on the stock market, it's of the order of $1.3 to $1.5 trillion a day, 97% of that is about speculation. It's got nothing to do with investing in things that improve the world. So the investor has become incredibly greedy. And I think that there have to be limits on that. How much is enough? Banks in Canada are incredibly profitable, and they announced we had a 50% increase in profit over last year. Well, when you look up last year they made record profits, and they keep increasing their percent increase in profit. So you ask them, well, how much do you guys need? You know, do you ever say, gee whiz, we're making so much profit, it's kind of obscene. We better start taking that profit and doing good things for the world. No, they never do that. Because all trade is about now is making more money. I mean, it's absurd. You and I can now buy money, hang on to that money, and then sell money and make more money without ever having improved the lot of people or ecosystems around the world. This is crazy.
You explain in the book, though, that there is some financial institutions that are changing, such as banking institutions in Germany. Could you just tell us?
There are a few companies, even one in the United States, Shore Bank, that are of course they have to make a profit, but they're driven by the desire to invest in socially responsible things. Shorebank has been very, very good in Canada in supporting Indigenous developments there among the native communities. There are companies in Europe that will invest in developing buildings that are green, developing projects that will improve the quality of air. That's what we need, are banks that will have an outlook that is more than just about making more money. You see, and there are also there are movements now to say we've got to put a tax on all this speculation going on. John Tobin, who won a Nobel Prize in economics, proposed a tiny tax on every transaction on the stock market. Immediately, of course, private sector said, no, 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 it's impossible, it's too complex. Then a guy in Canada was asked by banks to see whether it's possible, in fact, to do this electronically, and he found it was a piece of cake. That report was not released then. They tried to hush it up. He then quit, and he put it on the internet. So you can now get that study.
And that was Dr. David Suzuki, visiting Canadian environmentalist, and it'll be part two of that interview next week. And the Green Desk today was brought to you by Phoenix Drinks and Phoenix Foods.